Founding support for State of Wonder is provided by the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation. Additional funding by the U.S. Bank Foundation.
This is State of Wonder on OPB. I'm April Baer. Have you reached melting temperature yet? We're pretty close. This hour, author Kent Nerburn talks about the new movie made from his book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. It's a story about traveling with a Lakota elder, something that directors have been wanting to adapt for a long time.
But no one could find the funding to do it because it didn't have a dominant white hero. And I refused to let anyone turn me into the hero.
He told us about what it took to get it right. Also this hour, we have two artists for you to meet who took on an extraordinary collaboration to explore one of the 20th century's most devastating acts of war. And we will get lifted with the Portland State Chamber Choir. They're about to release this ravishing record of choral music by a Latvian composer. Critics rave about his work, but this is the first album of his compositions ever to be released in the U.S. All that's coming up, but first off, let's talk about the Oregon Arts job that could be one of the most important hires in the regional culture scene for decades to come. Chris Coleman is the artistic director of Portland Center Stage, and he goes back east sometimes to see what plays are hot, get some ideas for his own company. In fact, he was in New York just last week to see a show.
I was sitting just kind of chatting with this woman next to me beforehand, and she said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Portland." She said, "Oh, yeah, you're looking for a new director for the Regional Arts and Culture Council, right?" And I said, "How do you know that?" And she said, "Oh, a friend of mine is interested in applying."
We can safely conclude that the word is out. Portland is looking for a new administrator to oversee its $9 million arts office. This woman in New York clearly knew all about it, even though the job hasn't even been posted yet. The Regional Arts and Culture Council, or RAC, is not technically a city office or bureau. It's an independent nonprofit contracted by the city to direct arts granting and services using city and county funds as well as the regional arts tax. Its influence is huge. RAC grants support everything from the city's swankiest performance venues to film screenings in prisons, edgy old town galleries to elementary school classrooms. These kids from Boyce Elliott Elementary serenaded Portland City Council during RAC's annual State of the Arts report in late spring. Their mission? Create a formidable display of cuteness to demonstrate how RAC uses the city's arts tax money to fund music and art instruction in hundreds of classrooms across the region. The kids were followed by a documentary filmmaker, a theater actor and director, a teaching artist, and others, all testifying about other projects RAC funding made possible. Outgoing executive director Eloise Damrosch is a low-drama administrator who came out of the city's public art program. She talked during the April State of the Arts presentation about how RAC's game has changed during her time.
You know, we started as a tiny but mighty little bureau of Multnomah County in the city of Portland, and now, many years later, we're a flourishing tri-county nonprofit arts council. And because of that, we can expand our services and our opportunities across the region.
Damrosch talked about the flexibility that RAC has shown, setting up programs that could not have originated under a city bureau. But in June, Damrosch's retirement brought her 30-year tenure steering Portland arts policy to a close. And now RAC's looking for a new direction.
Eloise has been there so long, and now people are wondering, you know, what next?
Commissioner Nick Fish is the councilman who oversees the arts portfolio. He's not part of the search committee looking for Damrosch's replacement, but he has talked about priorities with RAC board members.
There's a lot of urgent questions about the future. From my point of view, we're looking for a strong leader. And leadership isn't just rhetoric. Leadership is demonstrated performance. We're looking for someone who has a record of building strong community partnerships. We need a cheerleader. We need someone who's an effective communicator who can get up in front of any setting, a business group, a visiting delegation, a student group, and make the case for the arts.
Jeff Hawthorne is RAC's longstanding director of community engagement. Since Eloise Damrosch retired, he stepped into a role as interim executive director. And he points out there are some RAC functions, like granting and maintaining the city's public art collection, that are very specifically laid out in its contract with the city. other obligations, like education work and a workplace giving program, aren't spelled out in the contract.
And in fact, our mission is fairly broadly defined to enrich our communities through arts and culture. And on one hand, that gives us a lot of opportunity to add services or to run programs that are responding to the needs of artists, arts organizations. But it could also let us experience mission creep. It's just very broad.
Thinking ahead to how RAC's next administrator might come to terms with all this, Commissioner Nick Fish and Mayor Ted Wheeler have asked for a city audit of RAC this fiscal year. Drummond Kahn is with the city's Audit Services Division.
We're anticipating a broad review, but like any audit, until it starts, we won't have the specific scope. In the request letter, the mayor and commissioner talk about the RAC's operations pursuant to its agreement with the city and to look at efficient and effective delivery of services. So we'll certainly consider those topics as we try to put some sideboards around the question.
If the audit can shed some light on what's being done and how efficiently it's done, the thinking is that the next ED will be able to set some new priorities. In the weeks to come, we'll introduce you to some of the people searching for RAC's next director and talk about competing needs for Portland, a city with a lot of creative spirit and an awful lot of gentrification problems to match. A few weeks ago, the British-born author Alexandra Fuller sparked controversy with her newest book, Quiet Until the Thaw. It's a novel about two Oglala boys on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and the outcry was immediate over how a white author handled a story about Native people. This is not a new controversy in the literary world, by any means. One author who's chosen to explore this tension very intentionally through his writing has quietly relocated to Oregon from Minnesota.
What you got there?
This is a scene from the new movie, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. A Lakota man, Grover, is reading through notes that white author Kent Nerburn made, based off the teachings of a Lakota elder. Grover is not impressed.
For us, it was the land, the place where the spirits talked to us. To you, it was just property, something to own in measure. The earth is our mother. Animals are our brothers and sisters. That looked like your sister.
They're his words, Grover.
No, they're not. They're your words. Tom bullshit. Boom, 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 boom. See that old dog? What's she doing?
Pissing, digging, scratching.
Well, if you was writing a book about dogs, wouldn't you put all that in?
Depends. Probably.
Well, you're writing a book about Indians. Put it all in.
The movie is based on Kent Nerburn's 1994 book about his travels with Grover and a Lakota elder named Dan. Dan had seen two oral history collections Ojibwe youth published with Nerburn's help. Dan then invited Nerburn to come turn his teachings into a book. The result, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, became a cult classic, and it sent Nerburn on a path to write more than a dozen award-winning books that have won praise, bridging the gap between Native and non-Native cultures.
We recommend his book a lot to a lot of people.
J.R. Lilly is the development manager for NIA, Portland's Native American Youth and Family Center.
A lot of people who read his book end up like, oh, that's why Natives are like that. So it is a good way of explaining our values through story.
Lily says that Nerburn has become a close friend of NIA since moving to town. The organization plans to take youth and elders alike to the Portland opening of the film adaptation of Neither Wolf Nor Dog on August 11th. Kent Nerburn stopped by the studio to talk with State of Wonder's Aaron Scott about the book's resurgence.
So Neither Wolf Nor Dog begins with you traveling to South Dakota at Dan's invitation to turn his life and his teachings into a book. But your first attempts are not exactly greeted warmly, and you finally hit this breaking point where you decide that you can't do this and you're going to go home, and then your car breaks down. Do you want to tell us what happens next that really sets this story in motion?
After my car broke down, I was trapped. I'm 100 miles from anywhere, and there was nothing that I could do. So I sort of threw up my hands, and along came Dan and his friend Grover, and said, ah, you know, we saw the smoke signals from your car, you know, with the vapor.
Literally the steam and smoke.
The steam coming out of the right under the hood. And so they said, come on, you know, don't worry about your car. This absolutely astonishingly huge mechanic that said he could fix it, that ran this junk shop, said he could take care of it. And so I just left my car, and they pretty much took me on a road trip through their world and their life and Dan's understanding of both the Native experience and the white experience as it impacted the Natives as he understood it. And he proved to be a very thoughtful, a very wise, and very perspicacious man whose stories and insights were incredibly valuable. And so that became the source of the book, and that became the content of the book.
And Grover takes you off-road, just literally driving through the Sea of the Prairie. You fall asleep, and you wake up on this rise overlooking this powwow, and you approach Dan, and I'd love for you to read.
Sure, just show me where you want, and let's go, let's do it. I stood up and walked slowly toward him. Listen to me, Nurburn, he whispered, placing his face so close to mine that I could feel his breath. The Creator has given you a task, just like he gave me a task. You need to do it right. I felt all my defenses drop away as I stared into his tiny, hard eyes. I want to, I said. I just don't know how. I really don't. I don't know if I'm the right person for this. That's not for you to decide. You just do it. I need you to help me. With that sentence, the whole world seemed to swirl inside my head. Help me, he had said. The one thing I most wanted to do. The one thing I felt least qualified to do. The one thing that I feared most about being a white man working with the Indians, that I would try to help and, like so many before, would do harm and damage I could not repair. Still, he had said it.
This scene really gets at the central struggle of the book.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how your mindset changed over the course of this journey of what it means to be a white man telling the story of a Native man?
I tried very hard only to be a conduit. As with the Oral History Project, I wanted to be clear water for their understanding of the world and their point of view. There's a constant tension between the idea that we are all human beings, we are all one, and we have to find what is common between us and among us, and the other feeling, the other sense that we are, that there's blood on the ground between us. In traveling with them, I've been able to cross that barrier a little bit and get to an honest sense of human commonality. I don't presume it. I wait until it's offered to me. I think of Wilma Mankiller, who was the head of the Cherokee tribe, once said at a gathering I was in that white people have such an astonishing sense of entitlement. They think that their good intentions allow them to go anywhere and ask anything and do anything. And I never forgot those words. And I, even if I have good intentions, it's not my decision on whether to reach out or not. I have to wait to have someone reach to me. And if they choose to look to the commonality of our humanity, if they look at me and say, okay, I trust your mind, I trust your heart, then that's a gift to me. And I accept it as a gift. And then I reciprocate with such skills and talents as I have. And that's what I tried to do in this book. And that's what's been so rewarding to me, is that this book now has remained alive, has been used by tribal colleges, been used in high schools, been used around the country, even around the world, because it serves as a bridge from the non-Native culture to the Native cultures. And I walk you, I walk the reader across that bridge. I say, come from where we are. Get out of the Gap, get out of the 7-Eleven, get in the car with me, and let's go for a ride. And I'm going to take you to some place you've never been and show you some people you need to meet. And I hand you over to their voices. I hand you over to the most authentic expression of their understanding and beliefs that I can create. And I get out of the way and let them talk back. And the fact that the Native people have embraced this book, that's the most important thing to me. It's the white people, the non-Native people, I should say, that I'd like to reach. But it's the Native people who I need to have their imprimatur. I need them to say, yes, you did it right.
So you returned to the reservation and wrote two more books about Dan, focusing on his quest to find his sister who disappeared after being sent to Indian boarding school. And Dan, or the elder Dan is based on, passed away in 2002. And now Neither Wolf Nor Dog is reaching an entirely new audience. Not only did it just get published in the UK, thanks in large part to the singer Robert Plant, but it's been made into a movie. Can you tell us how that came to be?
Ever since the book came out, people have said that needs to be made into a film. Well, over the years, a number of efforts had been made. Actually, a very well-known Hollywood director had wanted to do it, but no one could find the funding to do it because it didn't have a dominant white hero. And I refused to let anyone turn me into the hero in this book. I didn't want to see this become a film of car crashes and a white man gets wisdom by hanging around Native people. You know, the sort of undercurrent theme of places, things like Dances with Wolves. I wanted this to be an ensemble piece, and the Native people's voice was heard most loudly. So after several false starts, I happened to be out in South Dakota and saw that there was a man, a Scotsman named Stephen Simpson, who was showing a film in this little town of Rushville, right outside of the Pine Ridge Reservation, and he filmed it on the reservation. So I gave him a copy of the book. And so he finally just said, I'm going to do it. And he kept trying to find actors, trying to find people that could play the roles. And the role of Dan was the most difficult. Finding a Native actor who was authentic enough as an elder was almost impossible. So we were almost at the end of the rope when I forget who discovered Dave Bald Eagle, the man who ended up playing Dan. And Stephen said, this is the man that can do it. Dave was 95 years old.
He's also lived a life, I mean, as full as anyone in the 20th century, with ancestors who fought Custer, born in a teepee, went on to be a champion rodeo cowboy, as well as champion Indian and ballroom dancer who danced with Marilyn Monroe, and then a stuntman for the movies who taught someone like John Wayne how to ride a horse and handle a gun before becoming the head of the United Native Nations. The man lived an era that went from cavalry charges, and he was also a decorated war hero.
That's right. He got shot down over France, I think it was.
I think it was Normandy.
So
went from like horseback cavalry to an era of tanks, an era of open prairies, to an era of fences and giant industrial farms. Very much the era that Dan himself spanned.
Absolutely.
What did Dave bring to the role that complemented, expanded, or kind of changed Dan's own experience?
He didn't act. He embodied. His wife said to me, Dave wonders how you knew all these things about his life. He was the elder. He was who Dan was waiting to be.
This is Wounded Knee. He's standing on a grave.
He knew his limitations. And he knew he couldn't remember lines, he couldn't do everything that he had to meet the requirements of the script. And at the end of the filming, when they were on Wounded Knee, Dave just started talking about his own experience. Stephen threw the script away and let Dave speak.
It's your people that had the weapons. The government wanted to get rid of as many Indians as possible. They wanted this country. They wanted our land. They'd do anything to get it. The cavalry came with big guns. One soldier started wrestling one of the young warriors that had a gun under his coat. The shot went off, and that's what triggered the whole thing. Everything turned loose there. The army started shooting all the children, old ladies, old men, and they riddled them with bullets. Can you picture them?
So you're not hearing a script. You're not hearing acting. You're hearing this man whose family was at Wounded Knee, who grew up through the entire history of 20th century
experience of native destruction and loss speak from the heart, pour it out, and everyone just let him talk. And if nothing else comes out of it, the fact that Dave got to tell his story and tell the story of the Native people in his own voice means that the whole project was worthwhile.
That was the author and recent organ transplant, Kent Nerburn, talking with Aaron Scott. Their conversation covered so many more things, including what it was like for Nerburn to hear Robert Plant sing his praises and bring the book to Britain.
Kent was dealing with so many of the questions that I couldn't answer. So I became so engrossed in the whole thing that I decided to pick up the phone and find out who on earth this guy was and where was he and can I talk to him?
You can find the full conversation on our site, opb.org/stateofwonder. Also there, some info about the movie adaptation of Neither Wolf Nor Dog. It's currently screening in Corvallis. It opens in Portland at Cinema 21 on August 11th and in theaters across Oregon over the next month. It's a pretty incredible feat for an indie film with a crew of two and a primary cast of three. In a minute, a visual artist and dancer come together to remember the bombs dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. You're with State of Wonder on OPB. It's State of Wonder on OPB. I'm April Baer. 72 years ago, American pilots dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To this day, historians debate whether, as the United States maintained, the bombings were necessary to end World War II in the Pacific, or whether, as some critics hold, they constituted war crimes. This week, a visual artist and choreographer come together for a performance work called Suspended Moment. It bears witness to the annihilation of two entire cities and to the complex Japanese and American narratives therein. The team has performed this work in places with strong ties to atomic history, like Los Alamos, New Mexico, the Hanford site in Washington. Now they're bringing it to Portland for its fifth ever performance. Yukio Kawano is a Japanese visual artist living in Portland. She grew up in Hiroshima. I asked her what kind of city it had become in her girlhood.
Well, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s. There are huge economic growth in the city, and the Japanese government wanted to adapt American way of thinking about the war and the history of Hiroshima. Now I'm, you know, outside of Hiroshima and looking at the Hiroshima from the different viewpoint. They added this title, Peace City, but there is always this hidden sentiment, the silent voice, but that's definitely there.
Are war experiences something that people talk about with their children and their grandchildren?
So my grandfather, he was like 2,000 feet away from the ground zero when the bomb hit. When he was still alive, I asked him if he can talk about it. When I was small, I asked him if he can talk about it, and he says there's nothing to talk about because he won't understand. I think that's the common way that the first generation will talk to their children and grandchildren.
The performance space is dominated by these two sculptures that you made, Yuki. And they're imposing, but at the same time, they sometimes take on translucent qualities with the different lighting during the performance. After it only takes a minute to realize that these are models of the fat man and the little boy, the two atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How did you make them, Yuki?
So it's during my graduate school that I had this dialogue of asking myself, where is my art coming from? And during that dialogue, I had my grandmother's kimono hanged in my bedroom. And I was curious what kind of feeling and what kind of image I'll gain by dismantling the kimono. It was her hand stitch, like kimono is all hand stitched. I had a ripper.
A seam ripper.
Yeah.
What did that feel like, to dismantle the kimono?
It was very poetic, very zen.
It sounds like it could have been traumatic.
Well, the history is traumatic. So dealing with the history with the theme Leaper in my hand, which made it less traumatic and more personal. And then within that activity, I had this notion that I'm in a good place to talk about Hiroshima. And then the bomb image naturally came up.
One of Yukio Kawano's onstage partners for Suspended Moments is the choreographer and dancer Mishi Chavez. A native of Albuquerque, he grew up close enough to Los Alamos to have some feeling for the American half of this story. Chavez's practice is based in the Japanese performance style Buto. You may have seen it performed by dancers in white makeup, moving infinitesimally slowly. But Chavez's style is something a bit more kinetic and stately. In some sequences, Chavez puts himself through organic contortions, twisting and spinning almost out of control. Other sequences make direct reference to everyday activities on either side of the Pacific.
I've been really interested in what I'm calling daily gestures. I really am interested in human activity. Buto is about having tasks, but they're very simple tasks. I actually, in choreographing the piece, I've stayed away from any narrative around Nagasaki or Hiroshima. Because it would be really easy for us to create a piece that feels very preachy or very destination-oriented.
So it's not, first we're going to dance the prelude, and then we dance the wildfires, and then we dance the aftermath, and then we dance a resolution.
No, it's more around, so in the recent version, there's a section where I'm a person fishing. I'm children playing hopscotch. I'm a woman combing her hair. People were really affected by it. And like what they saw was a woman brushing her hair when the bomb dropped. But what I was trying to do was just say, here we are. Here's humanity.
Were there ways that you tried to keep the performance from becoming alien in the amount of suffering that you needed to communicate?
Yeah. And I think as the project, the different renditions of the piece, I think as it's evolved, I'm interested in more and more of that.
Like our goal is trying to bring this history to the present moment. And I think a lot of people in Fukushima and also Chernobyl too are thinking this way, that the future is really unpredictable.
That's Yukio Kawano and Mishi Chavez. Together, they're leading a Buto workshop this weekend. And on August 9th, they'll perform Suspended Moment as part of an annual event organized by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. It's called Remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, From Despair to Hope. Find all the info at our website, opb.org/stateofwonder. The Portland State University Chamber Choir sings way above its weight class. It regularly challenges professional choirs to top laurels at international competitions. This summer, it became the first American choir to attend Asia's largest choral gathering, the Bali International Choral Festival. And the PSU crew did not just attend, they brought home the Grand Prix trophy. This ensemble is successful in part because PSU has one of the best opera programs in the Western United States. But a lot of credit also goes to PSU's dynamic choral director, one Ethan Sperry. A prolific composer himself, Sperry has forged creative partnerships with collaborators from around the globe, in particular, one of Europe's hottest young Mozarts, Erix Eschenwald. The Portland State Chamber Choir has premiered a number of Eschenwald's work over the years, and this week it's releasing the first ever U.S. recording of his music. It's called The Doors of Heaven. Ethan Sperry stopped by OPB while they were recording the album last year, and he told State of Wonder's Aaron Scott about how he came across this young Latvian, well before Eschenwald's was discovered by the likes of the Boston Symphony.
I was at the National Choir Directors Conference. It was the year I started the Portland State, so it was the spring of 2011, and it was in Chicago. And a choir from Latvia came and performed at that conference, and it was the best choir I've ever heard in my life. Their name is Kamer, and they were singing a piece that I had never heard by this composer I'd never heard of named Erik Eschenwald's called A Drop in the Ocean. And I heard it, I was like, I need to do this. And we did it that spring with the PSU Chamber Choir. And we recorded it the next year on our first album, and we were the first American ensemble to ever record any of his music. Then I just reached out to him by email. I decided with Oregon Repertory Singers, which is a community chorus in town I conduct, I decided we would do his first oratorio, his first choral orchestral piece called Passion and Resurrection, and I'd invite him to come for the performance. And he said nobody had ever invited him to come to the U.S. to hear one of his pieces before, so he was really excited. He's been here several times since because we keep doing his music and recording his music. And he's become much bigger time. In the past year, both the Boston Symphony Orchestra and Utah Symphony have commissioned him to write oratorios for them. His second opera is being premiered in a couple of weeks. So we were hosting a National Choir Conference here in Portland this past November, and I decided what I really wanted to do was to do Passion and Resurrection again. I think it's the best piece that's been written so far this century, and I wanted all these choir directors from around the country to hear it. And so we did it, and we recorded it in January, and I sent it to Naxos, which is the largest classical CD label that still exists, and they're really excited about it, and they wanted a disc of all music of Erik Eschenwald's. So right now we're in the process of trying to record all the rest of the album.
I spoke with him about working with you guys, and this is what he said.
I'm very much interested to open all my heart, to share with Ethan all my feelings about each page of each work that will be on a CD. Because, you know, when composers are dead, then no other information. So, but I'm still alive. So, and about each piece, I give a comment, I share my thoughts, and I see this disc. I know that will be outstanding. Very, very important. Equal to my CDs, which have been already released by professional Latvian British choral groups.
He points out there that a lot of music, you're doing the works of people who are no longer with us. What is your response to that and the idea of working with a living composer to interpret his works?
It's my favorite thing to do. I mean, I really do love so much of the music of the great classical composers, but yeah, they are dead. I will never have a personal relationship with them. You know, everybody's music they write is to some extent a part of them, and when you know who a person is, you can help bring that to life. And he comes with very clear senses of what he had in mind when he writes the pieces, and he's very articulate about his librettos and his style. But he's also very articulate about the way he uses the choir, which is not block chords. It's your part does this, your part does that, and explaining people their function to create these unique sonorities.
Tell me about A Drop in the Ocean.
Yeah, so A Drop in the Ocean he wrote in memory of Mother Teresa, who he'd never met, but whose work he deeply admired. And it begins with Mother Teresa's favorite prayer, which is, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. And it's this very beautiful unison chanting in the sopranos. And then he tries to obscure it as if it's going on very far away and we can't quite hear the prayer going on. So some of the choir is whistling. Some of them are doing these weird breathing effects. The altos are all asked to chant the Lord's Prayer in Latin, but each at their own speed, which creates this sort of chaotic sensation that there's somebody standing in the corner of a cathedral and their voice is bouncing off the walls. And then some of the sopranos just sing this very simple, Lord, make me a channel of your peace. And other sopranos are asked to sing the same melody, but echoing at random. And then the tenors and basses change into yelling out the things that she's fighting against in the prayer. Where there is misery, let me bring hope. So they'll yell misery or pain, despair, error, hatred. And you literally feel the world that she lives in, that here's this fragile little melody and all around her are these horrific forces. And everything sort of explodes into this very loud moment. And then everything gets replaced by her most famous saying, my work is nothing but a drop in the ocean. But if I didn't put that drop in the ocean would be one drop the less. And the same melody that was at the beginning that was completely obscured returns harmonized by the most beautiful, lush jazz harmonies, although no jazz rhythms, just these incredible harmonies. And it's the same tune that's completely transformed. And I think it's a parable for her life. Her prayer turns into her drop in the ocean.
That was Ethan Sperry, director of choral activities at Portland State University, talking with Aaron Scott. The PSU Chamber Choir is releasing the first U.S. album of Eric Eschenwald's work on August 11th. It's called The Doors of Heaven. In just a minute, we remember the late poet Peter Sears. You're with State of Wonder on OPB. This is State of Wonder on OPB. I'm April Baer. Counties and towns in the path of the coming solar eclipse are all wrestling with two huge questions. Just how many people are going to show up for this massive celestial event? And how do we prepare for them? Travel officials are estimating 1 million people are headed to Oregon alone. Grant County is in the odd position of having experienced big influxes of people a couple of times, from firefighting teams to the rainbow gathering. Liza Yeager went to check out what they learned about staying open for business.
In a lot of sparsely populated counties, the upcoming wave of eclipse tourism is unimaginable. But Grant County has had to accommodate a huge influx of people before.
I got to get there because their fuel. Right.
Julie Carr owns the only gas pump in the tiny Grant County community of Dayville. If you're headed west, her station is the last place to get gas for 85 miles. She remembers August 2015 when massive fires were burning just a mile south of John Day. Hundreds of firefighters set up camp to contain the blaze, and basic supplies ran low.
Clear up to Yakima, there was no ice available. So we took our ice machine, put it in the back of a dually pickup, hooked it to a generator, and drove it to Idaho to a cash and carry and got ice. We have a photo of it. And that's how we provided ice to the fire camp that was here of 1,800 people.
This month's eclipse will bring exponentially bigger crowds. The Chamber of Commerce doesn't know for sure, but estimates that between 10,000 and 50,000 tourists will travel in or through Grant County on eclipse weekend. Back at the Dayville gas station, though, Julie Carr is feeling confident. She's got her own ice machine, and she's stocking up on essentials.
Oh, no, I'm not going to let things sell out. My goodness, if I ran out of chew and cigarettes, which would be a good reason for people to come to know the Lord, because that happened 2 weeks ago when I ran out of Copenhagen. I think three people came to know Jesus because we didn't have any. So, no, I'm not going to let that kind of stuff run out.
But at some local cultural centers in Grant County, it's kind of a different story. Just because they've seen an influx of people before doesn't mean they feel prepared or comfortable. The Grant County Museum in Canyon City is closing its doors for the whole week around the eclipse. Jane Primrose runs the museum, and she says she's nervous about keeping her collection safe with a small, mostly volunteer staff. The museum's collection of old pioneer clothes and gold mining tools are mostly displayed on shelves, unprotected.
A lot of our items aren't in cases because we just don't have the money to buy cases. We also pride ourselves on the fact that you can actually pick up an old whatever and look at it. You know, touch, I think, really has something to do with the learning process.
They're worried about visitors who might try to steal things or even just damage them. Primrose had similar concerns last month during another dry run for the eclipse. In early July, Grant County was the site of the annual Rainbow Gathering. It's this giant annual festival where old school hippies get together to build and live in a peace camp for a week. 12,000 people camped out in the Malheur National Forest, and the main road to camp went straight through John Day and Canyon City. Primrose closed the museum all week.
I'm sure we lost money that week that we closed. But that money that came in, or any amount of money that would come in when we have hordes of people from the eclipse, will not replace items that get stolen or damaged or whatever.
The Grant County Museum isn't the only one in the area shutting its doors during the eclipse. In John Day, the Ranch and Rodeo Museum is also closing down. Two other museums, the Kamwa Chung and Company Museum and Prairie City's DeWitt Museum, are staying open. Tammy Bremner manages the Grant County Chamber of Commerce, and she says small volunteer-run cultural centers or local history museums are often what make tourists love a town.
And, you know, I think it's really hard for the museums because they want to be open and they want, you know, but at the same time, you know, it's like, can I be here 24 hours a day, you know, for 5 days in a row? Am I going to have enough staff to do this?
The Grant County Sheriff's Department did not release information to OPB about crime statistics in July. So based on the Rainbow Gathering experience, it's hard to know how much grounding exists for fears about vandalism and shoplifting later this month. But on the business side of things, Grant County shopkeepers are putting any nerves aside and, for the most part, preparing to stay open.
People understand that this could be, you know, very beneficial and a big shot in the arm for the businesses. And you don't want to miss out on that.
Even if that means staying open 24 hours a day, stockpiling non-perishables, or serving a more limited menu than normal. And for those who might be disappointed that they won't get a chance to visit all of Grant County's local museums, Bremner points out that there will be many other options for eclipse tourist entertainment. A local outdoor concert and bikeable smoothie trucks and petting zoos and yard sales and bazaars and more. And maybe that will be enough to bring visitors back at a time when every museum in the county has the bandwidth to stay open. For State of Wonder, I'm Liza Yeager.
The poet and teacher Pete Sears has died. He was 80. Sears was Oregon's 7th poet laureate, serving from 2014 to 2016. Sears came to Oregon in 1974 from back east. He was active in the state's literary community for more than 40 years. One of his goals as poet laureate was to broaden the base of the global linguistic community, as he called it, meaning that instead of reading by himself as he traveled the state, he sought out people writing creative work in their native languages to share the stage and read with him. In 2014, he spoke to OPB's Think Out Loud about the importance of reading for poets and how much he enjoyed sharing the stage with other writers.
Oregon's very good about that, about representing people from different communities.
Sears said, as a poet, he walked a line between describing the world and writing things of his own invention.
Of all the values, human values that we hear about that are wonderful, drive, resolve, insight, charm, empathy, whatever, we don't hear much about imagination. And it's really, really critical. And we live there a lot more than we know.
Here's Pete Sears reading one of his poems entitled Night Golf, a great example of working with your imagination.
We tee off under the moon and walk into my first hole of night golf. My ball is nowhere. I drop another ball and send a seam along the dark. This ball I lose too. I like to swat the moon night tingling, but I will lose no more balls. I pretend. I swing on a ball I imagine. My friends stroll over and say I am picking up the game fast. Thanks loads, I say. At the top of my backswing, I see myself naked. I laugh, go to my knees. My friends laugh with me. I try again. I swing without a club and walk under the ball I see floating to the green. There I stroke a long putt, my head down, over my follow-through. I don't keep score. There's no score in night golf. You swing and look your ball into the dark. You walk with friends across land you don't know. saying little, allowing your stride to find a softness you vaguely recall. You may go far with yourself, far, and be content by morning. If not, the day floats until the moon rises.
Pete Sears encouraged all kinds of writers to explore their passion for poetry and did not want it to be seen as an elitist sport.
I like to read people's stuff back to them. I like to just read it with gusto.
Born in New York, Sears graduated from Yale and from the Iowa Writers Workshop. He moved to Oregon to teach at Reed College and later served as dean of students at Bard College. A beloved teacher and writer, he expressed commitment and passion for his craft and to the state. He worked as the Community Services Coordinator for the Oregon Arts Commission and as director of the Oregon Literary Coalition. Listen to this. This is another former Oregon Poet Laureate, Paul Ann Peterson. She's the person who preceded Pete Sears in that office. She held him in very high regard, both as a poet and as a human being.
He is so wonderful with people of all ages and funny and quick, and his poems are brilliant. He's set.
Here's one more poem by Pete Sears, Dream of Following, exploring family and aging in one devastating series of lines.
I am following my father and mother, following them although I don't much like the idea, and I don't much like that the distance to them grows smaller. So small I'm catching up to them. You'd think we'd have much to say to one another. We don't. My father motions me to look back over my shoulder. Mm-hmm. There's my daughter following me. Mm-hmm. That's mean of him. I want to hail her, tell her to slow down, but I don't. I turn back. They're gone.
That's the late Pete Sears. He was the author of three full-length poetry collections. His award-winning work has appeared in national magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times, The Atlantic, Mother Jones, and several literary magazines. Pete Sears passed away at his home in Corvallis on July 20th, 2017. Once upon a time, a few hundred years ago, there were two kinds of keyboards, soft ones and loud ones. If you wanted to play loud and soft on the same instrument, you were out of luck. Then one man in 17th century Florence changed that. Bartolomeo Cristofori invented what we now call the piano. Portland writer Elizabeth Rush tells his story in her new children's book, The Music of Life. Rush and her pianist collaborator David Safford joined OPB's Dave Miller on Think Out Loud recently to talk about the book and illustrate what makes a piano so special. Let's listen to them performing an excerpt from the book.
Cristofori's invention, eventually called simply the piano, becomes a powerful tool in the hands of brilliant composers everywhere. Ludwig von Beethoven's piano rings out, rousing and full of joy. Clara Schumann's piano sings. Claude Debussy's piano makes moonlight.
Dave Miller asked Elizabeth Rush and David Safford how they combine elements of reading and recital when they're presenting together.
Well, that's one of the things that's so fun about this project. I wrote the book because it's about music. I tried to write it as musically as possible and really use a lot of sound words. And so, you know, I just sort of asked him, I said, you know, would it be possible to put this to music? And we talked about some of the passages, like where I talk about Cristofori choosing hammers. I said, you know, can you play something that sounds like hammers? And when you're talking about the harpsichord, can you, even though you're not going to be playing a harpsichord, can you play something that sounds sort of robotic. And so it was so fun.
I can imagine harpsichord lovers taking issue with that
phrase. Oh, I know. Sorry,
but
harpsichord
all right.
lovers.
But you're a piano writer. It's fine.
My apologies. But it was just so fun to, for each spread or each page, talk about, well, can you make something that sounds like a fountain? Because at the end of one spread, I talk about how he's working in his private workshop and with the sounds of clinking plates in the background and the splashing fountains.
So Liz, why write a book about the invention of a piano? I mean, it seems like a very specific story for a children's book.
The piano is such a widespread instrument. It's played all across the world by people of all ages. And to me, it's actually kind of remarkable that we know who invented it. It was 300 years ago. And, you know, that we can actually point to one person. There are so many instruments that there are many people who work on it and refine it. Whereas with Bartolomeo Cristofori, he created the mechanism that made it possible to play a keyboard instrument both loud and soft. And so the fact that there was just one person was quite remarkable.
That was award-winning biographer Elizabeth Rush and pianist David Safford with OPB's Dave Miller talking about the new children's book, The Music of Life, Bartolomeo Cristofori and the Invention of the Piano. The book's beautifully illustrated. It's in stores now. To get info and hear the long version of the interview, go to this week's show page, opb.org/stateofwonder. That's our show for this week. State of Wonder is produced by Aaron Scott. Our technical producer is Stephen Cray. Production assistance by Elena Yusin and Liza Yeager. The executive producer of the show is Sarah Rothenfletch. Music for today came from Audio Network. I'm April Baer, and we certainly hope all the hotness of the past hour hasn't melted you away. Hopefully you can find an artsy corner to ride it out or plunge in this weekend. Next week, we have more for you on the search for RAC's next executive director. Also, the life and times of Oregon's greatest architect. Till then, stay cool. Keep it wonderful. Bye-bye.